Hi, this is State Representative Mark Strama from Austin, where we're mad at Lance Armstrong for using performance-enhancing drugs, even though we kind of love Willie Nelson for it. Welcome to TribCast.
Thank you, Representative Strama, for that drug reference. To kick off our TribCast, this is Reeve Hamilton here with the fourth week of January TribCast. Joining me is Editor Emily Ramshaw.
Good morning, Reeve.
Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Morgan Smith, reporter at the Texas Tribune.
Hello.
Off to a good start.
Yeah, this is a really high energy deal.
Well, we've used some performance enhancements of our own.
I was going to say
this TribCast.
The legislature
legal ones.
Use a few performance enhancing.
Yeah, why isn't Starbucks sponsoring this?
I know, seriously.
We should get on that, actually.
It's right. A great idea. Fine. Talk to April.
Yeah. Well, I thought we would, on a more somber note, start off with yesterday's shooting at Lone Star College. It seems like, from all the reports, that two students got into an argument and started firing on each other. Do we think that this will have an impact one way or another on campus carry legislation?
It becomes another point in an argument that's already underway. I mean, you know, this argument's already engaged. It was, you know, in the president's inaugural speech. The governor's going to make his State of the State speech next Tuesday. The legislature's already filed a bunch of bills. This becomes, you know, another one of the examples that they're going to cite during the arguments, I think.
Well, this one kind of seems like an example that you could use on either side. It's not a situation where you have an outsider who's deliberately coming in with the intent to kill as many people as possible. This is the kind of situation where there are two people whose argument was then escalated to, you know, further violence or further harm because they both had guns. So it feels like it could be, you know, then you could say, well, if somebody else with, like, you know, a calmer head had a gun too.
Right.
And they wouldn't
helped,
be shooting at each other? I don't see how.
But
you
yeah,
really
I mean, it's this is kind of, I think, a little bit different than some of the other situations that we've seen, because you could see somebody arguing against a campus carry bill with this, I think.
I mean, but the fact of the matter is these guys were campus carrying. I mean, you know, obviously this is
going to happen anyway.
Allowed, but I think the argument that the campus carry folks are going to make is, you know, clearly we aren't preventing people with weapons from showing up on college campuses, you know, whether it's authorized or not. So, you know, who says that these lawbreakers get to carry guns and not the people who are trained and, you know, might be able to de-escalate a scenario like that? Or they might end up, you know, shooting around to try to quell the violence and end up, you know, killing even more people or injuring more people in the process.
And campus carry's been filed again, right? Jeff Wentworth's gone. But
yeah, it's Brian Birdwell filed
Brian
it.
Brian Birdwell's been.
Yes.
Carrying the torch for Wentworth, yeah.
Yeah, Wentworth filed it in the last two sessions and both times wasn't able to ultimately get it through. There was that dramatic moment on the floor of the Senate last session where he thought he had 21 votes and then some of the votes that he thought had been promised to him suddenly we're not with him anymore, and you couldn't get it.
And there was a point where he had attached it onto a higher ed bill that was from Senator Zaffarini, and then she pulled down her own bill because she didn't want it.
This
passing.
Bill is always good for some high drama.
Totally high drama, but isn't this also a bill that, in general, colleges or universities are pretty opposed to?
A lot of them are. I mean, you know, I think the president of Rice was down here last time. I mean, you know, a lot of the police chief from Rice, maybe. A lot of them, you know, don't want a bunch of guns on campus.
Right. I mean, my recollection of this bill is always that, you know, this is something Republicans push for really hard in the legislature, and it sort of comes close to passing the Senate, where it always starts, but that you always have all these university administrators from around the state, and including law enforcement from, you know, university police departments saying that they oppose this.
No, it's better. I think in the academic world, it's better this near universal opposition to a policy as you're going to get.
Well, shouldn't that matter?
I mean, when it's your constitutional rights, you know, what does it matter what the universities think?
Right, and there's a split here between the private campuses and the public campuses too. You know, the state can order it or allow it. You know, the private campuses have a little bit more leeway to go against whatever the legislature says here.
Mm-hmm. And from a practical perspective, I mean, aren't there all kinds of, like, liability and legal and kind of insurance issues that are raised?
Well, that was brought up last session. I think Rodney Ellis brought it up. People out of Houston brought it up that this would really hurt their insurance. And I think a lot of the campus carry proponents had never heard that argument before. So it's not entirely clear the situation on that.
Mm-hmm.
Worth looking into again, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if this, you know, if you're looking for an example of an incident in Texas that helps you really, you know, push for campus carry, I'm not sure this is it. This sounds like sort of a strange scenario. I mean, it's, you know, it's not a Sandy Hook. But at the same time, I think they're going to be using anything. You know, this was in Dan Patrick's district, right?
I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. He was, you know, tweeting about it like crazy yesterday, you know, sort of following and trying to, you know, it didn't appear like he was spinning it in any way, but he was, you know, trying to be very clear about what the scenario was and who was involved. And I thought it was sort of interesting to sort of watch it through a political lens to see if we see any movement on this or if this is used as a particular example. But, I mean, what's the latest with public school
legislation? Yeah, because, I mean, as that has kind of reignited some of the discussion of campus carry on higher ed campuses. At the same time, you know, since the shooting in Connecticut, there's been a lot of discussion from lawmakers about what the state can do on its K through 12 school campuses to increase security. And then you also are seeing a lot of schools in this, or a handful of districts in the state, that are reconsidering allowing their employees to carry concealed handguns on campus. And the way the law is now, school boards can approve any person to carry a concealed weapon on campus. There's one district that has had a policy in place since 2008, and that is a tiny district out near the Oklahoma border. And what they do there is people who already have their CHL licenses, so they've gone through the training from the state, can then apply to the school board. When they're approved by the school board, they then go through additional training about how to react in a school situation when an active shooting occurs. And then after that, they can come on to campus and do it. And we've heard, you know, the lieutenant governor has said that the state should set aside funding for these kinds of programs. Yesterday, we heard a proposal from two senators and Dan Huberty in the House saying that the state should give school districts taxing authority to be able to raise local money to pay for security operations. There are kind of a lot of proposals floating around out there, and I think there's also a lot of uncertainty from school districts on what exactly they are permitted to do under the law as it stands now, and what the liability and what kind of the risks they run if they do decide to change their policies. So
there's also a fair amount of conversation about what kind of training you would have to have handguns on campus. One of the routes into this is a conversation about if you're going to allow some school personnel, whether it's teachers or administrators or whatever, to have guns on campus, exactly what training should they go through, and there may be some legislation there too.
So if it's already permitted, I mean, if school districts can already do this, what does the additional legislation do? I mean, aside from like the taxing one, for example.
So Representative Vialba is planning on filing legislation that would create a program that's modeled on the federal fire marshals, where I guess it would set up a structure for school districts to, you know, pick a couple of people on campus that they want to be. They want to be these, I guess, deputies that would carry weapons or have this special training. And I think a lot of the legislation, and that has not been filed yet, so we don't know the details, but I think some of the efforts at the legislature might be to provide some kind of structure or, you know, get funding at the state level for school districts to kind of follow and get guidance. Because right now, it's kind of like, you know, there are 1,300 school boards out there that are just kind of looking around wondering, like, what exactly are we going to do? We heard about this one district over here who does it this way, but our lawyer's saying we can't do it that way because of this and that. So I think that it's something that's in the air right now that people are talking about, but I think a lot of eyes will be kind of on lawmakers to see if they can provide any kind of clarity.
Well, allowing them to raise local taxes doesn't exactly provide clarity on what they
right.
should or shouldn't do.
Exactly.
Right? It's just sort of
well,
you can have money to do something.
I mean, this is sort of a sidebar, but it is interesting that this is such an exigency that you can actually sort of break the
no new taxes
wall. You know?
Right. I mean, the other thing that's interesting is, you know, nationally, this argument and the big argument that the NRA has been making is that, you know, we should be focusing on mental health. You know, trying to get guns out of people's hands. hands is not the solution. But, you know, in Texas, where you have a state that spends less money per capita on mental health than virtually any other state, you know, I haven't seen any legislation yet that's sort of beating that mental health drum. And maybe
because they had trouble understanding that NRA guy as much as you did, apparently.
Yeah, maybe.
And yeah, I mean, when I've heard lawmakers talk about this, the security issue, and you know, I think they always kind of say it, and also, you know, mental health is important. You know, you'll occasionally hear them kind of say that out loud, but almost all of the proposals that we've seen have been focused on, you know, what do we need to do to get people better armed in schools and that sort of thing. So,
right. I mean, because the cost, you know, and nobody's talking about a local taxing district to, you know, improve mental health care in communities. I mean, the cost to the state of trying to tackle that problem would just be, you know, exorbitant. I think it seems like a quicker, easier, dirtier solution is just to, you know, make it easier for people to have guns on campus.
There's a fair amount here of people just wanting to put their stamp on this, not
right.
really having an idea, you know, that something ought to be changed or not changed. It's just, I want to have my name in the story about, yeah. you know, fixing something.
Yeah, and I work to improve school,
right.
you know, security for your child.
Right.
On that note, do you expect this to come up in the governor's emergency items if he comes up with any in the next couple of weeks?
You know, the governor has this period of 60 days at the beginning of a session where he can dictate what the legislature is considering. And I can't imagine. I mean, there's been the story that Rick Perry's not going to have any emergency items. I guess he's told the caucuses that he might not. You know, you're walking past a golden opportunity. Why would you do that? I mean, this is certainly one of the possibilities.
Well, let's move over to, Emily was just talking about mental health services. Can we switch to women's health services? And there seems to be this question
coming
up.
Yeah, you better
up.
Not be making a connection
yeah.
between mental
what is
health
the connection?
Reeve, you're all alone.
Not outside of this room, I'm not.
Morgan and I are going to storm out of the podcast.
Like crazy people.
And the transition.
Yeah. That's great.
Well, you know, in heading obviously into the early days of the session here, there's been a lot of conversation around the courts have virtually for the time being said that the state can really continue to operate this women's health program without Planned Parenthood. So we have a situation where Planned Parenthood is virtually off the table for state subsidized programs in Texas. They're not in the women's health program. They're not receiving family planning dollars from the state. So the question right now,
are they doing anything?
Planned Parenthood?
Yeah.
Well, they're operating privately, obviously, as they, you know, have for a long time. And they have, you know, pretty deep pockets nationally. I think that this is an organization that none of us should think is going to go anywhere anytime soon. But they've taken a big hit, and some of their clinics around the state have been forced to consolidate or close. So the question becomes whether the state can continue to run the women's health program without Planned Parenthood, which was providing, you know, like 40% of the care under the women's health program. So the state has been sort of, you know, playing defense and sending out all these lists of providers and saying, you know, not only do we have enough providers to cover the women that are in this program, we have even more providers than they had when Planned Parenthood was here. We've really done a great job recruiting. On the flip side of that coin, you have some feisty Democrats going down that list of providers and making cold calls and having the providers say, no, we don't serve women under this program.
Well, it sounds like the lists are just bogus. I mean, you know, auto parts stores or something.
The lists,
you know?
are not bogus. What the lists are is they included, you know, one provider, say, may have one doctor who accepts women at one of their locations for this program, may not accept women at the four other branches of their program. And so, but all of the different addresses were listed in this list. So then, you know, you started, and that they say was an oversight, and they ended up pulling down the list. They're fixing the list to put it back up. But I think it's really sort of hit their argument pretty hard because they are saying we have enough providers, yet when some of these calls are made, the providers are saying, no, sorry, we don't treat those women.
So did the legislature make its decision to cut out 40% of the providers by cutting out Planned Parenthood without knowing that the network was big enough, or did they cut it out with bad information from HHSC?
They cut it out because they were going to do anything at all costs to get Planned Parenthood out.
Even if it disabled the rest of the program?
Even if the program, they were confident that they could recruit enough providers to make the program work. But at that point in time, you know, this has been a get Planned Parenthood out of the program at all costs, no matter what happens.
Well, I get that, but did they do any investigating on what it was going to cost, what kind of a program they would have if they cut it out?
They researched it, and they said they believed they had enough providers. They were confident they had enough providers. Again, now they've run this big survey, and they're still confident that even though the lists have been a little bit wonky, once we get the list cleaned up, you'll see, indeed, we do have enough providers. So they're really standing behind this, and the reality is we're not going to know for months whether they have enough providers, because we're not going to know until, you see women, there aren't as many women in the program, or women aren't getting as many services, or they're not, providing as much birth control, or, the 9 months from now, you start right. seeing a higher birth rate or more unexpected pregnancies. And that's, that's really going to be sort of the end game when they know.
Well, and you moderated this discussion with Representative Donna Howard, Democrat of Austin, and Sarah Davis, Republican of Houston, this
yes.
week on this topic. And what was your big takeaway from that? Especially, I guess, what does Representative Davis think?
Right. This was interesting because we have a lot of these debates where you have people on polar opposite sides of the political spectrum, and then it's just sort of, throwing bombs at each other. What we had yesterday in this interview was Sarah Davis is a Republican, but she's on the pretty far left side of the spectrum when it comes to women's health issues. She's a breast cancer survivor, and she was the lone Republican to vote against the sonogram bill in the 2011 session. And she's, a very strident advocate for increasing women's access to family planning. Now, she did vote for some of the family planning cuts in the last session, to move that money over to, say, autism or the, deaf and blind, in a time of some sort of serious budget cuts. But She's an interesting case study because, she's sort of the lone Republican who's out there saying, this is not fiscally conservative what we're doing, and, getting in between a doctor and a woman is not the right place, not the right thing to do. So both she and Donna Howard, there's some conversation sort of brewing about potentially some bipartisan initiative to restore some of these family planning dollars in the upcoming session now that Planned Parenthood is, out of the program altogether. My takeaway from yesterday's event was it's going to be shocking if that money gets restored, because there's just I will be really surprised if they have enough momentum on the right to at a time when really family planning and abortion for all intents and purposes in Texas are synonymous in the legislature, and I just think it would be surprising to see any money get moved in that
right.
direction.
If Sarah Davis in her sophomore session can pull her entire party over with her.
Right. She may not be at a huge risk of a primary opponent. I mean, her district is pretty divided politically, but I don't see her being able to convince a whole fleet of other Republicans that this is the right thing to do.
Well, and if the results of these cuts are so spongy, like you say, it takes a long time to figure out whether a program's been cut or to see an effect. Is there any real political risk to voting against funding these programs?
Right.
I mean, if you don't immediately cut off services to somebody who can then vote against you, what's the political risk?
Right. Well, Sarah Davis said this yesterday. Twice now there have been numbers released showing that there's going to be a big spike in births. LBB, the Legislative Budget Board, did it in the 2011 session. HHSC, the Health and Human Services Commission, has released new numbers showing that they expect 24,000 unplanned pregnancies in 2014-2015, and additional 24,000 pregnancies deliveries. At a cost to taxpayers of like $273 million for those 2 years. That's real money. Those are real births, but they're projections. And I think, until you see it actually happening and until you're faced with, budgeting with those numbers,
right.
It's hard to make the case.
Well, and how did we get to the point where family planning and abortion are synonymous kind of in the whole political climate? Is it because Planned Parenthood is just such kind of like this evil figure in discussions, and Planned Parenthood is synonymous with abortion for a lot of people, and it's also the clinic that's providing contraceptives and other type things for a lot of the women who are enrolled in this program?
I mean, I think that's a lot of it, is that you have, similar services provided at the same place, but I think if you look back to, a decade ago, or a little more, family planning was a totally bipartisan issue. George W. Bush was a huge proponent. There were lots of efforts, statewide and nationally to improve access to family planning as a fiscally conservative thing to do. But over the last decade, you've seen sort of the increasing polarization around abortion. You've seen increasingly, you know, Planned Parenthood being held out there as this organization that, you know, well, there's no way for us to know whether they are using this money for family planning to perform abortions. You know, folks who on the right who are concerned that there's really no, you know, curtain that you can draw to be sure that that funding isn't used for another kind of service. And so I think you've just seen increasingly them being associated with, you know, the state Republicans demanding that they be out of business.
Right. You have this whole spectrum of services that includes abortion, and they're so opposed to abortion that they outlaw the whole spectrum.
Right. Yeah. So what will be fascinating is for, you know, for the Republicans who say they do not equate family planning with abortion, that those are two separate things, then this is their session to act, because Planned Parenthood is out of the programs entirely.
And right. Is there kind of identifiable Republicans out there who have taken that stand besides Sarah Davis, or is it kind of more something that has to happen behind the scenes?
It's sort of spongy. They're kind of forming up, and they're all sort of hiding under the table until they're ready. I mean, you know, there's a group of them, and you know, it's sort of the group that you would expect. It's the people that the very conservative Republicans call rhinos and call moderates. But you know,
which is a category that anyone can jump into at any time if they decide to suddenly take the wrong position.
Right, and everybody's so afraid of having a target painted on them that they say, you know, you get a lot of conversations that are sort of like, I'm for this, but don't put my name on it for now.
Well, it's like that Eric Erickson column, right. Where he's the main guy over at Red State, and he did this thing, sort of the loyal opposition column, on the occasion of Obama's second inauguration, basically being like, look, we can't be outraged about everything all the time. And I think Planned Parenthood has become one of those things, right? It's like everything is sort of simple and polarized and easily just like, well, let's just get rid of it.
Right.
Instead of like dealing with nuances. And that's what he was writing against. And then instantly you got some commenters that are just like, oh, he's always been a rhino.
Right. Not a purist.
But let's look ahead to... not look forward to, but look ahead to when there might be some new leadership in the state, so 2030 something.
You're not looking forward to that?
No, not necessarily.
He'll be old.
We now know that Miriam Martinez from Edinburgh is running for the Republican primary.
She's the new Margaret Thatcher. She's part Eva Perón and part Madonna.
Part Madonna, quote, yeah.
Right. Is that what she said?
That's mm-hmm. what she said. She said it about her own self. If wow. I'd said it about her, she would have complained.
Yeah, but, I can't wait for the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical about her life.
Who's the last person who compared themselves to Madonna?
You know.
Katy Perry.
Morgan singing in the shower.
Yeah. does her announcement that she's running for the Republican primary for governor in 2014 change anything?
No.
remind us of what kind of her backstory is.
She ran for state representative last time.
She was born in Tamaulipas and was naturalized in 2010. And
going back further.
Ran for, well, I mean, but it's part of her story and it's part of her rationale for this thing. And ran in 2010 for the state house, lost to Bobby Guerra, who's a new freshman rep this time. And she now does a TV show, radio show, some stuff like that. She does a lot of media stuff. But her pitch is, you know, it's time for a Mexican-American governor of Texas, and I'm your candidate.
Is there any precedence for someone losing their first state house race and then winning the governorship?
Probably. Who knows?
What about, we also got now reports coming in that Julian Castro says he's not running for governor in 2014. Does that change anything? This, you know, Democratic mayor of San Antonio.
You know, I think that's probably a realization that, you know, it's not time yet, you know, or that he thinks it's not time yet. You know, the question for Democrats is who's going to be the first one to break this long Republican streak of wins that started in 1996, statewide office. You know, and periodically we have somebody pop up, you know, whether it's Bill White or Chris Bell or Tony Sanchez or whomever. And Castro either doesn't think it's time in 2014 or doesn't think he's the candidate for 2014.
Does the 2 and 4 year term drawing in the Senate have any bearing on who we're looking at in terms of 2014?
I think it could. I mean, you know, the drawings are going to take place, I guess, a little bit after we tape this. And the idea here is that if you draw a 4 year term in the Senate, you could run for statewide office in 2014 without giving up your seat in the Senate. But if you draw a 2 year term, you have to choose between running for reelection or running for statewide office. Part of that's going to depend on what offices are open. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about Wendy Davis running for governor. If you play the game of if Abbott runs, the AG's office is open, if Combs runs, the controller's office is open, you get all of the senators and House members who would like to run for statewide office starting to look at those things, and you start that whole musical chairs game.
But of course, if you say you're not running for something, that doesn't mean you're not running for something.
It never means, you know, that never means what they say. The only definitive statement is, I'm going to run for that office. And everything else is sort of subject to time and circumstance.
Well, coming back more recent to more in the moment sort of news, what do we take away from these Senate committees that were recently named?
You know, Morgan probably has a better take on this than I do, but the Senate Education Committee looks stacked. It looks like they put
a lot of
conservative faces in there and took out some Democratic stalwarts.
Which means what? Stacked in favor of?
Well, you have the chairman, Dan Patrick, who has been a very vocal advocate of expanding school choice in the education system. That's something that is popular among conservatives, but has, you know, it causes division even among Republicans. But I mean, if he has a lot of supporters on that committee, it's going to help him move that legislation through. But I think the thinking on that is more that the House is where it's going to encounter most of its obstacles, rather than the Senate. But you have new faces on that committee. You have Ken Paxton, Larry Taylor, Donna Campbell, who are all kind of considered to be among the conservative senators who are coming in. But then you also have Kel Seliger, Duncan, who are both kind of the rural Republicans on education issues that tend to support more things that the traditional kind of establishment public school advocates support on these issues. So, and then of course you have Senator Lucio, who's the vice chair, instead of Senator Davis, who kind of has been very outspoken on education issues. And so there's going to be a lot of shifting around on that committee. Right. You know, even though you kind of have Senator West and a few others who have kind of been the longtime members who are, you know, know their way around the issues and all of that. So,
right. You know, some of the Democrats who were stronger last time than they are this time. You know, there have been a lot written about Zaffarini. Mm. She got moved to a different committee. That committee had a bunch of its duties taken away. Rodney Ellis didn't have the committee assignments that he had before. I think, you know, part of this is the story that we've all kind of been watching since Dewhurst lost to Ted Cruz, is Dewhurst moving to consolidate, you know, whatever support he has on the right and making sure that, you know, he comes out of this looking like a conservative. He says he's going to run again. He's got to mollify the people who voted against him last July in favor of Ted Cruz. And I think the committee assignments illustrate that.
Is there committees besides education where you're kind of seeing some of that pattern?
You know, the government org committee that Zaffarini got, you know, is a big one. They had, you know, it was the committee where they sent all the sunset bills. The sunset bills are the agencies that are up for temporary review every 12 years.
And there's some big agencies up this time.
Right. The expiration date on the milk carton comes up and you have to be recreated by the legislature in order to continue forward. And it makes the committee chair, if all of those go to one committee, it makes quite a gatekeeper of that committee chair. And so Dewhurst moved Zaffarini from higher ed to that committee, and everybody thought, well, you know, Railroad Commission's going to go through here, TEA is going to go through here, all of these big agencies. And then they came back when they did the Senate rules and said, you know, let's send those instead of to government organization to the substantive committees that deal with those subject areas. So TEA is going to education, and Railroads going to business and commerce and so forth. So, you know, I think we'll see some of this play out as the session goes forward. You know, one of the things that's interesting about if you try to cut out a Zaffarini or an Ellis, you know, they've both been around for a long time. They're both really smart about the system. And, you know, they will both find ways to be players if they want to. You know, there's some famous kind of historical cases of this, but it's hard to take a senator who knows, you know, what they're doing out of the process.
Well, and if any listeners want to be a player in our comments section, they can email their questions and comments to tribcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of Emily, Morgan, Ross, and our producer, Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
This better be good because we stopped the podcast for you. Just kidding. That was a joke.